You're listening to This Rhetorical Life, a podcast dedicated to the practice, pedagogy, and public circulation of rhetoric in our lives.
In late October, we had a visit from Brisa Kirsch as part of the Rhetorical Listening and Composition Colloquium and Workshop Series. We were fortunate enough to have an opportunity to sit down and chat about her presentation titled Mindfulness, Creativity, and Feminist Rhetorical Practices. Our conversation revisited some of the points that she made in her talk, but also delved into more pedagogical concerns, which still dealt with topics such as listening, mindfulness, and civic engagement. My first question was inspired by a pedagogical concern that I have been exploring recently. As I was thinking of a structured first-year composition pedagogy, where there is an emphasis on genre focused around an argumentative format, but also considering the exploratory writing and mindful contemplation that Kirsch describes in her article, From Introspection to Action, Connecting Spirituality and Civic Engagement, I asked what were some of her thoughts on how we could better bridge the two.
Yeah, I would say I do teach an exploratory writing course where I do quite a bit of exploratory writing. And I think, you know, even though maybe ultimately we'll write a research paper, you know, on a topic, I find that it's a very good way to get people to discover topics that they care about. Mm-hmm. So I would say that I still do a lot of exploratory writing and mindfulness writing and topics that we, you know, sometimes based on reading, sometimes based on their own experiences, sometimes based on what they major in, you know, so I invite them to bring topics to class. And I do a lot of short writing, free writing, you know, regular, sometimes in class, sometimes out of class, where, you know, that exploratory, that are not graded and sometimes not collected, you know, just, but that enrich the conversation, that we, I can invite them to, you know, open the discussion, see what shows up there. And I find, you know, that, and sometimes even the first assignment, you know, sort of an exploratory kind of writing. I teach one course where I focus on sense of place and really look at, you know, environmental or urban planning issues, you know, eventually large problem spaces, as I would call them. But they often begin from a personal journey, you know, where the sidewalk ends in front of your house when you're forced to change modes of transportation. That tells you something about how we live and where we are and, you know, or places they have come to know as children and love. And I think that's always a good place to anchor somebody, you know, why do they care about this park and, you know, who takes care of it and what does it mean about other places like it or people who don't have access to beautiful spaces like that. So the kind of discovery writing, I find that fun, and I send them on self-guided field trips, which is also fun to see where they go, you know, and then they bring back what they discover or explore or see or learn about, even, you know, often they're new to the Boston area, so that's enriching that way too. Some of them, it's the first time they've ridden the subway, you know, if I make them go in the city, which is not that far. We're 10 miles from Boston. Mm-hmm. So that all of those are, I think, for me, my attempts at inviting them to explore and through exploration discover topics they care about. Mm-hmm. And I think once you discover what you care about or a piece that relates to your life or your major or, you know, what, then you can really dig your teeth into the research piece. Mm-hmm. And, you know, you have more passion for it and more commitment to it. And then I think in the, you know, end run that produces richer writing, I would hope.
Based on her answer, I noticed that she doesn't necessarily collect or grade the students' exploratory writing. So I asked her about her approaches to assessment.
Yeah, I mean, I do different things, but I like portfolio grading, and, you know, only because it allows students some control of what they select to put in there. You know, I will put some framework of two or three essays, or they have to write an introduction, and some pieces count for a little bit more, but some control, because I tell them that's how real writers work. When you write or for your dissertation, you don't throw everything at your professor. Blah, here's my everything I produce, but you select, you craft, you focus on the things that you think are your best work. You might, you know, for some writers, I even tell them different, showing me the different skills they have. Sometimes different genres or papers show different skill sets that you've learned. You know, you frame that and then you hand that in. And I think that's a richer way of grading than sort of the randomness of it. Yeah, so I'm...
Yeah, the assessment.
Yes, yeah.
And so it would be like at the end of the semester.
Yeah, and I usually give them a midterm grade just to give them a sense of where they're at so they can sleep better at night. Mm-hmm. And I tell them if they're really nervous, they can come in after 2 weeks, bring me all their work, and I would give them a, you know, what I would give them if the semester ended now. So I don't want them or their parents to lose sleep over this. So,
great.
You know, I try to make myself accessible, but yeah, I typically give them a midterm grade. And then the real grade, you know, is based on their portfolio. But just And they get lots of feedback, you know. It's not that they don't get feedback, you know. We workshop things and people help them identify what writing strategies work and which don't. And, you know, so I spend a lot of time giving them feedback. But, you know, as soon as you put a grade on it, the discussion is, why is this a B plus and not a B or vice versa? Yeah, not, you know. And then you spend your energy focusing on that grade difference rather than what strategies work, what can you learn, what do you see yourself. I mean, I'm pretty... help to encourage them that I think learning to assess your own writing is a very important skill. And I try to, you know, help them learn that too in their class. Because eventually you don't have a writing teacher there. So you need to think about audience and context and genre and have some good questions to ask about that length and style and tone and all of those things. So I hope, you know, help. My goal for them is to become self-sufficient writers who can assess that and understand and have some terms when they're writing in different contexts.
Great. So. Sounds
That's what I hope for. You know, it doesn't always work out perfectly, but that's why we live and learn.
Yeah. And I'm thinking of Peter Elbo, which you quoted in ranking.
Yes.
Evaluating. So the midterm kind of meaning and giving them a potential grade.
Yes, right. Yeah, right. Right.
That's... Thank you so much. That is very helpful for me, at least.
Yeah, I hope you get to explore that. I think it's a little tougher in your spot. You know, I have probably a little more autonomy as a professor. And I do disagree with some of my colleagues on sort of the... who just see the academic essay as the valuable thing and nothing else counts. And I don't see it that way. And we agree to disagree. So I think, you know, you will have that authority, you know.
Yeah.
But I think it's good to explore that place, you know. The other thing I tell... you know, I don't like to really give teaching advice, and I think I talked about that in the little graduate student meeting. So I think it has to come from who you are, you know, what resonates with you. So I think having faith in that, you know, if you teach from what's deep inside you, then you will reach people. You'll see it in their eyes, you know. So I think, you know, the technique is not it. It's really, you know, something that you value, and you can explain why you're valuing this and how you, you know.
Yeah, with heart, I think.
Yes.
Yeah, no, I definitely appreciate that. Considering the activity that Kirsch described in her talk, in which students go out to certain spaces to investigate their sense of place, our own Allison Hitt was motivated to ask about how we can better account for students' bodies. So I asked on her behalf.
Yeah, I do a number of things. I do very short exercises sometimes with students in class, and I think you're absolutely right there that the different abilities and needs and desires are complicated. And I have to tell you, I'm not sure that I'm always totally mindful about that. I try to be, you know. I invite students to tell me, you know, and our disability service is very clear about that, you know, if students need accommodations, you know, we must meet them. And I'm always, you know, offer that in the beginning. I'm not sure that students always feel comfortable coming to that. And I know that there's some nervousness. I do try to set up a class atmosphere where people are comfortable, you know, engaging, that is respectful, that people listen thoughtfully, that they're respectful. I always tell students that they have a, you know, if I go around in a circle sometimes to go for feedback, you know, they can say that they're passing, you know, that they don't want to speak right now, because I like to respect people's, you know, who knows what's going on in their lives. Their parents are divorcing, you know, and they had a, whatever, a tough time. So that's, you know, I mean, one way in which I try to be accommodating, you know, sort of physical disabilities, you know, kind of what I learned from, you know, our disability service is very great at accommodating things. But yeah, I do think it's challenging. I do know that people have different levels of comfort, you know, degrees of introversion, extroversion. Mm-hmm. You know, I try to create a space where people feel free to speak from, you know, when they want to speak and what they want to share. Yeah, I'm not sure. I mean, that's an ongoing, I think, process that I need to think about as we do things. We sometimes go outside for like a 5-minute writing exercise. I want them to observe something very particular and then write about it and we come right back. So yeah, that requires physical mobility, it requires a willingness to stand still for a few minutes and observe, requires the ability not to look at your iPhone. You know, that's probably maybe the biggest piece of challenge that people have. So yeah, that's also, I think, ongoing things I explore. Not sure that I have a strategy. I think I'm trying to invite students to feel comfortable talking to me outside of class. And then working around that is what I try to do.
Good.
Tell me about yours or what you have learned or thought about.
I mean, I've been this semester... I've always been careful about students not participating and then prompting them to participate mm-hmm. when they don't want to.
Mm-hmm.
And I've seen some students that demonstrate that they're not comfortable with that, my approach of like mm-hmm. name calling sometimes. Mm-hmm. And then I'm becoming more aware of that as I keep teaching. And this semester I was going through some personal problems as well. So I, as a student, I was participating
yes.
in a workshop, and the workshop was to had us write, and then it was a prompt of like three questions, and I just didn't want to do any of it, right?
Uh-huh.
I'm just like,
yes.
What I kept writing was, I don't want to be here. I shouldn't be here. Things like that.
Uh-huh.
And so, like, that was definitely a moment. And as you were saying, that sometimes it's not even a physical limitation. It's, you know, some kind of emotional trauma
yes.
that we're going through at the moment,
yes.
you know? And so,
mm-hmm.
After that, when I experienced it personally, now I'm just like, okay, I really need to be careful with what I have my students do, like, as in making them do
mm-hmm.
things.
Mm-hmm.
So definitely
mm-hmm.
negotiation. I think that
mm-hmm.
that would definitely help. So
yeah, I find it useful to be a student. You know, I actually occasionally enroll in adult ed classes. So I know in other contexts, if I go to my yoga class, like, or whatever instruction class I go to, like when you resist, you know, yourself. So kind of just to notice that and then understand, you know, that that's sort of part of how we interact, and that, of course, you'll see that in your classroom, and
mm-hmm.
to be mindful of, you know, the places we come from. So I think that's good insight for you and early on to learn that. I mean, it's tough, but
yeah.
I think it helps you appreciate the range of what might be in front of you.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
yes.
Definitely. Maybe it's
yes.
so aware of it.
Yeah.
So...
You know, there's a little book that I think I referenced in one of those two articles. It's called Radical Presence by Mary Rose O'Reilly. It's like 30, it's not even a book, it's a booklet. But it's very powerful. She just talks about like three or four teaching stories where she just listened. It's really about the ability to listen and be present, and just sort of how that transformed some teaching moments for her. It's very engaging. It might be a nice little read to, you know, tough stuff with students, but just the ability to sort of pause and invite them in and not guided and see where it goes. So I like that little book.
Yeah.
I hadn't thought about it, but when I was rereading these pieces, I'm like, yeah, that's a good...
I'll definitely
yes,
check it out.
Take a look, yes.
So, thank you. So, I'm going to read the Ben's question.
Yes.
During the talk, you mentioned an example where a teacher says to the student, 80% of the project should be defining and understanding the problem, making sure that you have the right problem, so picking a
mm-hmm.
topic. Then the 20% can be on the solution. In the writing program at SU, we do a lot of civic engagement with our students, and these classes are motivated and enriched by action, the possibilities of using writing as social action. But these sorts of classes also seem to perhaps fetishize action and in the process override our ability to do the strategic contemplation or mindful, thoughtful inquiry these important moments of community engagement require. I'm wondering what thoughts you have on this possible tension between action as a motivation and mindfulness as a necessary part of responsible action.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's a nice question. I like that question. Yes. So those 80-20, it might be even 90-10%. I really learned that from my business colleagues who teach a lot of sort of design. This comes sort of from design spaces and what they call problem spaces. Really thinking about what you are identifying as a problem. I think that's true in writing and research. And I think it's very important with civic engagement. You're really understanding the cultural context, the social context, the structural issues, you know, when you're looking at a space and pausing and not thinking, well, I have the solution, I'm moving right in there, but to kind of look at the larger framing of it. And so if you look at design schools and sort of the curriculum from like the Stanford School, they spend a lot of time like looking at a large area, you know, I'm thinking about, you know, the health space, you know, like, do you look at the hospital admissions process? Do you look at how people live? I mean, you know, it can go all kinds of, you know, it can go lead you down to nutrition and diet, or can it help you identify a food desert in a city, you know, if you have a high rate. So looking at where the issues are, you know, it's large and social spaces like that. So you can move from the hospital admissions and emergency admission rate to, you know, poverty and employment and unemployment and, you know, nutrition and education, you know, so you poverty, you know, can go into a large space. So I think, you know, at some point you do want to narrow in onto some space, but I think understanding the richness of these spaces is really important, because otherwise you're just becoming sort of the imperial person moving in there, maybe with good intentions, but not with learning. I mean, that's been a big critique of civic engagement and also a particular service learning, where students just feel like, oh, I'm doing the good deed and I'm helping out without really making any profound difference or changing their understanding of how things work. So I think it's a tension, but I think it's an important spot to pause. You know, I think I'd rather have my students understand the complexity of issues. And I'm thinking about Patrick's class right now. I was just visiting earlier, where he teaches, looks at the prison culture and the whole, you know, industrial prison complex in this country, which is very, very, you know, disturbing and complex, and, you know, that concerns a lot of people. But rather than just rushing in and let's write a letter to the prisoner, you know, which they're doing a piece of it too, but understanding the depths of which our society is dysfunctional, you know, and incarcerates, you know, particularly black men, you know, for a lot of reasons. But, you know, to undo that cycle, I think is, you know, I mean, that's a really big problem space.
Okay.
But, I would...
So what I hear you saying is that so that instead of focusing on positing a potential solution or going into these mm-hmm. particular communities, it's better to do the exploration and kind of the inquiry into mm-hmm. the larger societal systems mm-hmm. that create the problems?
I mean, I think an understanding is necessary. Mm-hmm. I do believe in community work, so I'm not saying don't stay out of them.
Okay.
I would be very thoughtful of thinking about how you work with community members and inviting community members to see what their needs are and not going in and identifying it for them. Mm-hmm. So I think, you know, working in the local space is very important, but really as a true collaboration. And that requires you to be able to change, you know, and adapt and move, you know, what you think you might have been doing. I know of a few, one good example, a colleague at the University of Illinois, Champaign-Urbana, he had some money, he was in the library studies program actually, they were working in a Puerto Rican neighborhood in Chicago. And, you know, were willing to put some of their funding there, maybe grow the library or do this, but they understood that they were coming in from the outside, from a, you know, school down south. And so they invited community members, especially young people, to identify their needs, what they thought was useful. And they ended up doing very different projects. The funds did not go to books. Some of them wanted to kind of build more on their Puerto Rican heritage. And so they wanted to study their food and music and culture. And so they developed means of doing that, you know. So they had places where they could develop and practice the music. They had developed a rooftop garden where they grew the ingredients necessary for some basic dishes. I mean, and they really enriched the community. And just, it's kind of the best example I could think of, where somebody had the mindfulness to say, we have a little bit of fun, we want to work with the community, we're interested in engaging, but let's work with the community to help us to find that.
Yeah.
And very cool project. Now, I think, you know, the challenges with sort of semesters, you know, that I think our, at Bentley where I work, you know, the service learning project, we have a pretty good center, tries to have long-term relationship with community partners, so that is not just this one in, one out. And I think that's the problem, can be the problem with that. But if you really have a commitment to the community or a certain center, and you really work with them, help them identify their needs, where they want to put their priorities, then you get true collaboration and really exciting learning and unpredictable solutions development. So I think I always have that as a very cool, exciting project.
A big thank you to Gisa Kirsch for taking out the time to sit down and chat with us, and to Patrick Berry for setting it up. Thanks again to all of our listeners for your continued support.
This Rhetorical Life is brought to you by graduate students in the Composition and Cultural Rhetoric program at Syracuse University. Executive producers of This Rhetorical Life are Ben Kiebrick and Allison Hitt, with additional production and editing from Carrie Ann Soto, Tamara Isak, and Seth Davis.